self-love, self-care, and radical social change. Costumes are encouraged. Again, that's Dance and Resist, Raise That Fist, a live broadcast dance party on February 25th at 8 p.m. at Open Signal Portland Community Media Center, 2766 Northeast Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from ADX, a collaborative hub offering access to shared wood, metal, screen printing, jewelry, and digital design shops through a monthly membership program. The ADX Makerspace Learning Center and Fabrication Shop allows people to bring their ideas to life. Open every day at 417 Southeast 11th in Portland and at adxportland.com. Also from the Garden Spout, specializing in indoor gardening equipment, including horticultural lighting, environmental control, hydroponic and organic nutrients, and pest control. The Garden Spout is located at 4532 Southeast 63rd, just south of Foster in Portland. Information at 503-788-GROW. And here comes Stephanie Potter with the Recovery Zone.
Hi, you're tuned to the Recovery Zone on KBOO Portland. I'm Stephanie Potter, and this is a show focused on healing our world. Today's show, we're going to be taking a look at the many benefits and the actual need for carbon sequestration farming, or otherwise known as regenerative agriculture, and how it can especially help climate recovery and ocean health. My guests today are author and environmentalist John Rulak, who should be on the phone with us. He's from Richmond, California. John is also founder and CEO of the superfoods company Nutiva and has founded five ecological nonprofit groups, including GMO Inside and the Nutiva Foundation. He's also written a bunch of books, including Backyard Composting and Hemp Horizons. And here with me in the studio are Kristen Olson, author of The Soil Will Save Us, How Scientists, Farmers, and Foodies Are Healing the Planet, and a lot of articles on these topics, which can be found on her website, kristenolson.org, right?
Com.
Kristen Olson. And she's also, she's got a myriad bunch of interests. So I guess right now she's working on a book about Native Americans or something. Anyway, lots of stuff. And also we have Jordan Fink. He's a permaculturist and founder of World Tree Project, who's now working on a book basically about how we repair the climate. And he's going to be probably trying to crowdfund this book. Kristen and Jordan were on this show several years ago, just after the publication of Kristen's book, The Soil Will Save Us. And a year and a half ago, Jordan was on to talk about these issues and his efforts to get World Tree up and running. And do we have John on the phone right now? Great. Okay, John.
So, what do you
mean? Hi, John. Welcome. I initially wanted to return to this topic about regenerative farming after I read an article by John Rulak in EcoWatch. It was titled, Spaceship Earth, Your Main Oxygen Systems Are Collapsing. And John wrote about how the plankton levels in the ocean are declining. And actually, much of the oxygen we breathe comes from plankton. But he also wrote about how we could solve this problem through regenerative agriculture. So, John, let's just start with the whole thing about the plankton. First of all, could you just tell us how much they're declining?
Yeah, thanks. Yes, good question. So there's unfortunately there's not a lot of information that's being put in the media, so a lot of people aren't aware of this. But for instance, there was an article that talked about the plankton in the Indian Ocean that had declined over 30%, so somewhere between 25 to 30% has disappeared over the last like 50 years. And when you take modeling where you increase the ocean acidification and you have plankton live in those and that kind of environment, they slowly, the shells dissolve and the plankton die. So you can literally, it's just literally by like kind of turning up the volume on the ocean acidification, and it dissolves plankton. So plankton can't live in a high ocean acidification. We've increased in ocean acidification about 30%. It's technically not. We don't have an acidic ocean. We have it's alkaline, but moving towards the acidic scale. And as I said, the acidification process has increased about 30% in the last 50 to 100 years.
So 30% acidification, 30% plankton decline, and a lot of this acidification is basically because of the climate change, right? I mean, the ocean is sequestering more carbon.
Yeah, the main causes are the oceans are warming, and the oceans are a major sink for carbon. So as we release the carbon from the soil, from agricultural practices, from industrial animal agriculture, from burning coal, drilling for oil, that carbon goes in the atmosphere, not only just stays in the atmosphere, it also falls in the ocean. So we have the opportunity, instead of leaving the carbon in the ocean, leading to reducing our plankton, which reduces the oxygen supply of the planet, we can take that carbon and put it back into the soil through photosynthesis. And it's a great way to mitigate climate change.
Well, one more thing, because I want to talk about that. But tell us a little more about the plankton. How we breathe, a lot of our oxygen comes from plankton, basically, right? And could you talk about that just a second?
Yeah. I think some people think that we get our oxygen from some factory that's just produced, or some people think it's in the rainforest. But over 60% of the oxygen in the world comes from the small phytoplankton that live in the ocean. So we're an ocean planet, not a land planet, and our very survival that makes this planet, you know, hospitable for us is based on the healthy ocean system that has phytoplankton that produce oxygen, and we're in the process of eliminating that oxygen and changing the conditions where it grows.
Jordan had just a little comment on that.
Yeah.
Would you like to say?
Yeah, of course. Thanks for having us. So one example I can give of this is that we know that the Amazon rainforest actually is pretty self-contained with its oxygen supply. It produces a ton of oxygen, but it actually uses a lot of that oxygen as well and doesn't interfere or doesn't give that oxygen to other systems. But what it does do is it feeds the plume that comes out of the Amazon, the mouth of the Amazon, into the ocean. And that gigantic plume of phytoplankton provides one of the largest amounts of oxygen for all of us on the planet.
Uh-huh. So it's not the Amazon air that we're breathing. We're breathing the phytoplankton from the ocean that
the Amazon in some ways is actually contributing to, though.
Yeah.
And another issue that we're dealing with a lot is that when we get high nutrient loads in the ocean from agriculture, from these systems that John was talking about, we get algal blooms that cut out oxygen from the ocean. They bloom high and they just create dead zones.
Right.
And we know that almost every single major extinction that's happened on this planet has happened because the oceans have lost their oxygen, and they've started to become anaerobic, and they release hydrogen sulfide gas, which is a killer for land life.
So that's like and eventually, I mean, if we're talking about this continuing, we're talking about all of us suffocating or else walking around with oxygen tanks, basically.
Well, many people talk about the Gaia hypothesis, that the planet has this sort of self-regulating ecosystem. But in some ways, there's two different ecosystems at work on the planet. One could be called Gaia, and that the astrobiologists at the University of Washington call Medea, who was a goddess that killed her children.
Oh, God.
And these two ecosystems, one tends to be aerobic. It tends to be oxygen-oriented, and it tends to create a system that humans like to live in. And the other is anaerobic. And that system is useful on the planet and does a lot of things to store carbon, including. But it takes apart a lot of the systems that we need to live.
Right. Well, I want to get back to John again, and actually, well, you guys can keep interrupting. But so the farming practices that we're engaged in with right now, John, you were saying, are contributing to this problem. And there is another way to farm, right?
Yeah. So I'd like to say that if agriculture is the you know, the perceived problem right today, it's also the solution. And so what's kind of ironic is that the in the past, you know, like the environmental movement tend to like blame, oh, you know, these are good, these are bad, et cetera. But today now, you know, environmentalists, you know, ranchers, farmers, permaculture people are looking to work together in a solution to essentially farm in a way that brings carbon back into the soil. That's whether it's cover crops, whether it's using compost, you know, grazing animals in a different manner versus just having them penned up and create, you know, concentrated animal feedlots, which are like worse than coal burning power plants. So there's lots of good ways to do this. Millions of farmers already practice this, and more people are focused on this in the U.S. So it's a growing movement, but we need to accelerate it, not only to get more people to practice growing food this way and raising animals, but also consumers and people who buy food. I like to say we vote three times a day. So one is eating less meat and milk is a first good step. And then if you are going to eat meat and milk, make sure that it's pasture based and not grain fed, because the big problems with grain is it erodes a lot of soils, and it uses a lot of herbicides that they grow in the Midwest for corn and soybeans.
Uh-huh. And so basically, we're talking regenerative agriculture, which I want to get into as the show goes on. And John, you might not be with us the whole hour, but Kristen and Jordan know a lot about regenerative agriculture, so we're going to totally cover that. But basically, the other issue going on here is that you sort of brought that... like a lot of farmers and people are getting on board with this, although I read somewhere, I think it was in Kristen's article something, it was only 2.6% of the nation's croplands right now are using cover crops. So we've got a long way to go if we're really going to get there. And we're going to get more into what are cover crops and why they're so important. But the other issue seems to be that activists, like you wrote another article, John, about how the Paris Climate Agreement didn't even mention soils and oceans in the Paris COP.
Yes, ironically, the Paris COP 21, that
and that was
ocean
in December 2015.
Soils.
Yeah.
I'm sorry?
December 2015, that agreement happened.
Yeah, December 2015. Yeah, the oceans and soils were not even on the agenda. And how can you talk about climate change when you don't deal with the two biggest carbon sinks in the world? And part of this, there's two sides to the reason why that's the situation. Number one is that the powerful agriculture industries, from Monsanto to ADM to Cargill to the multinational food conglomerates, they don't want people to understand that agriculture is the largest contributor to climate change, not the oil industry, not the coal industry. So if people realize that we could sequester carbon, that means that we need to use less chemicals. We need to use we need to use cover crops and not chemical fertilizers in transition to that, and so that's number one. But the second thing that is less understood is that we face a situation today where the environmental movement, and I'm talking about whether it's 350.org or Greenpeace or some of these large environmental groups, they're environmentalists, but they don't seem to understand ecology and ecological systems and how they interact with nature. And so their primary focus is carbon is bad, which is kind of dualistic. Carbon is bad, and just stop drilling for oil and coal, and don't buy so many cars, and don't drive your car, and do that. And that's all good. We need to do all of that. But if we follow that model, and we build as many solar panels, you know, we put as many solar panels as you can imagine, and if you made Elon Musk the energy dictator for the next 10 years and you followed everything that he said to do, if you do all of that with what's going on with India and China, even if they accelerate all that, we will reduce the species population on the planet by, in my view, by 90% by 2060. 90% of all species will not be on this planet
by 2060.
We will lose the oceans in the next 2 to 3 decades, where there will be very little left living in the oceans because the plankton will be gone. And so, so the environmental movement is saying, stop drilling for oil. Exxon's the problem. Chevron's the problem. And that's, as I said in one of my articles, that's 50% of the solution. The other 50% of the solution is we need carbon sequestration. And Dr. James Hansen, one of the most preeminent scientists in the climate movement, says the only path forward is sequestration. We have to sequester that carbon. And ironically, the environmental groups do not deliver this message. And I wrote an article to them. I sent every one of them a FedEx copy of it. They many people have talked to them, and they still won't. They won't tweet about it. They won't write articles about it. They won't do campaigns. And so it's ironic that environmental groups' plan will not solve the situation. And we need a plan. I know that sounds a little pessimistic there, but we need a plan. And we do actually have a very good, thoughtful plan in a new book out by Paul Hawken called Project Drawdown. And this will be out. And Paul Hawkins, which, you know, is the founder of Smith & Hawkins, has written a lot of different books, Ecology of Commerce. He went around and talked to all the major environmental organizations all over the world. And he says climate change is the number one issue. Where's your plan? And guess what? The environmental groups don't have a plan. They have a campaign to criticize what's the current system. But as Bucky Fuller has told us, the visionary environmental designer in the 60s and 70s, you can't just fight the system. We have to create a better system. We have to create a better thing that people can move towards. And so that's what the regenerative agriculture is about. Is here's a model to do this. The challenge we're facing is these environmental groups don't seem to want to talk about it. And part of it is their funders are saying, they're not coming to them and saying, hey, help us tell the story of how industrial agriculture is so bad, and here's a solution, and here's $20 million to do a campaign. They are doing that to say, go do more solar and shut down coal-burning power plants. So It's this irony situation that we're in.
I just want to pause here a second. I have to do this every 15 minutes to let people know you're tuned to the Recovery Zone on KBOO Portland and listening to John Rulak, Kristen Olson, and Jordan Fink, who are talking about the necessity for and the benefits of regenerative agriculture that puts carbon back into the soil. And you can call in with your questions. The number here is 503-231-8187. And I was talking to you just a bit earlier, Kristen. You were agreeing that climate activists have to get on board with this. Could you add to that a little?
Well, sure. It is really frustrating. I think I understand that the, human beings are often motivated by fear and panic, and I think that the environmental movement has sort of leaned on that as a motivator. We have to talk about this really terrible thing that's going on, and it is a really terrible thing that's going on. Climate change is a really terrible thing. Loss of biodiversity are really terrible things, and I think that possibly there's a view out there that talking about solutions, talking about the land, regenerating the land is a solution. And I think it's possible that they feel that that's not as motivating as fear. That they feel that might take pressure off the gas and oil companies, the energy industry, to pull away from fossil fuels. But he's right. It's really a terrible problem. That being said, though, I do have to say that in my work, I write a lot about agriculture and regenerative agriculture and farmers who are innovative and pioneering and really trying to make a difference in their practices, that there are, I think, just about every environmental group is working with agriculture in some way, like in the article that you were talking about, which I did for NCIA.com, which was looking at what are some of the obstacles that prevent a lot of farmers from going over to regenerative practices. And a lot of the obstacles are just sort of clunky bureaucratic things that exist. But one of the real hero environmental groups is the National Wildlife Federation. They are working with farmers and really pushing the idea of cover crops. Now, cover crops, it's possible not all listeners know what cover crops are.
Right, we'll have to get into that.
So the whole thing about regenerative agriculture is understanding that there is this tremendous life in the soil, and that there's this tremendous relationship that life is all about, and that the relationship when it comes to agriculture, it's plants and these microorganisms that are in the soil. Billions of microorganisms in a teaspoon of soil. So that's a habitat underground, and one of the huge problems with conventional industrial, whatever you want to call it, agriculture, is that it does not regard that as a habitat. It disrupt, you know, there are all these practices that disrupt and cause that habitat to lose function. So one of the things that agriculture does, and you can see it if you drive on the highway, you know, you've got farms on either side of the road, you see bare fields everywhere,
right,
as farmers have often cleared those fields off in the fall for their spring planting. So that's, you know, 7-8 months of bare soil. So one of the things that happens when you do that is that you stop that relationship between plants and the microorganisms in the soil. You're starving those microorganisms in the soil, and it's an extremely unnatural state. So cover crops are an attempt by farmers to keep something growing, keep live roots in the ground all the time, keep pumping the carbon exudates that plants produce,
and they, and
during
they produce
photosynthesis.
And provide them to the microorganisms in the soil and keep those microorganisms alive.
Right.
Sugars and things that
yeah.
the microorganisms
yeah,
feed
yeah, yeah.
on.
So that's what cover crops are. And so anyway, the National Wildlife Federation has this very big campaign to work with farmers on helping them understand and start to use cover crops in their fields, because you know, the National Wildlife Federation is doing it because it makes farms so wildlife friendly.
Right. Right.
But it also has all these other benefits of making the soil more fertile, building up the carbon in the soil, you know, putting more biodiversity in a field. So there's just so many benefits.
Right. Did you want to add something to that, John?
Yeah. I wanted to add that. Also wanted to mention is one of the major environmental groups, the Sierra Club, which has a long, lustrous history in protecting natural resources. They historically haven't done as much in agriculture. They've been, you know, maybe back a few decades ago, but they've been more focused around energy and forestry, et cetera. I've worked with them back in the 90s on protecting California's redwood forest in some of my campaigns, forest protection campaigns that I participate in. But they've are now focusing in on food and ready to launch some campaigns. So it's good to see the Sierra Club. And they were one of the groups that I mentioned in my article, and they actually were very open to having a dialogue with me, and they're working on some of these things. So we are making some progress, and it's good to see. I mean, you know, they can influence a lot of people. It's just that my concern with the environmental movement is they have so many members. There's millions and millions of members, and these people could all be changing their diet. You know, it's hard to, a lot of people, it's hard to, you know, to buy a new car. And if you do buy a new car, you know, it's, you know, not everybody can afford to buy one, but you can change your diet a little and eat a little less meat and buy more organic and buy more regenerative foods. And so that's a positive thing. We don't necessarily have to blame corporations, or other organizations. We can look to make that change in our own life and look to make the influence with educating others at the same time.
How do we know if the food that we're eating is coming from a regenerative farm? Is that labeled somehow?
That's a very good question, and there's a big debate kind of in our movement about that. The one thing I would say is if it's organic, that's definitely better than non-organic. But organic, certainly, a lot of farms aren't necessarily... Organic means you're not using chemical fertilizer, you're not doing this, where the purpose of regenerative agriculture is, let's say the carbon level is at 4% in the soil, the organic matter, you want to increase that, so you work to improve it, so you're regenerating, you're increasing the fertility, whereas organic, a lot of farmers just maintain it, and some of them actually might even decline, and some of them might increase it, but at least you're not using synthetic fertilizers and other things. So definitely is organic is better. And then if you're going to eat any dairy or meat products, if it's 100% pasture based, then that is much more regenerative than cows that are just in industrial pens and things. So that's one way you can do that. It's something people just need to learn a little more about, how our food is grown, you know, going to the farmer's market, for instance, instead of going to the supermarket, et cetera.
Right. But basically, you know, like if I am buying organic lettuce, it's hard for me to know if it's come from a regenerative farm. I just know that it's not using a lot of...
There's discussions about that. And it's not so easy to certify that, and there's discussions about that right now. But definitely organic is better than non-organic,
right,
which you use in synthetic fertilizers.
Well, and I think one of the things that John said about going, you know, going to a farmer's market, it's just sort of the bigger story about knowing who your farmers are, knowing who is producing your food. So even grocery stores are starting to get into that. You know, lots of times when you're going to buy meat, you know, it'll say these chickens came from such and such a farm, or these things were restaurants are now having that story, having that narrative about who produced the food. And so, you know, there are ways that we can learn more about who's producing our food and who to give our food dollars to.
Right. Do you have a comment on that? Okay, we'll let that go. But I just wanted to say then that I think we're talking about regenerative agriculture, and there's I want to talk about, like, I think there's four aspects to it that I could sort of figure out. There's no tilling, there's cover crops, there's actually using livestock in it, and there's a whole lot less fertilizer and pesticides and all that. And could you maybe talk a little about exactly, like, for instance, we were talking about cover crops, what they do. Why is no tilling so important?
Can I give a little bit of background here?
Sure.
So one thing I want everybody who's listening to think about is a seesaw, the two sides of a seesaw. And one of those sides we have erosion, and the other we have deposition, which means building up.
Uh-huh.
And on this planet, there is a balance always happening between the creation of more ground.
More soil
piling
up.
Also the parent material of the earth itself, the actual, like, bedrock lifting up because of geological processes.
Uh-huh.
And then there's the rain, and there's heat, and there's frost, which breaks apart rock. There's this process of erosion. And the earth is this constant balance. Everything you look at on the land is a balance between erosion and deposition. And most landscapes on the planet, which are uninterrupted by human activity, have more production than erosion. The land is slowly building up. The soil is slowly building up. And this process over millennia has what's stored most of the planet's carbon that's not in the deep oceans, has absorbed and moved and built up soil. Now, agriculture and tilling, even organic agriculture, even early agriculture, contributes because it moves and breaks up that structure of the soil, and it makes it more able to go into the air. The organic matter breaks apart. The binding connections of the fungi and the ability of the bacteria to live in an oxygen-rich environment instead of an anaerobic environment, all of those things are taken away. And what that leads to is that carbon in the soil starts to oxidize and becomes airborne, or it washes away and goes downstream. That's contributed to a massive amount of CO2 into the air as it's converted into CO2. Soil scientists are estimating that between 50 and 80% of the problem CO2 in the atmosphere is due to the contribution of soil loss.
Wow.
And that understanding that cycle is super important, but it also means that it's this little switch. On one side, there's more erosion. On the other side, there's more soil production. So we need to think about what are the activities and practices that over time contribute to slowing down that erosive process and expanding and improving that soil building process. And every single one of the things we do in regenerative agriculture, and also in regenerative development, designing our towns and cities so that they do the same thing,
right,
is trying to improve that balance so that water is stored and slowed and helps feed soil building processes rather than suffocating those processes or eroding them, and allowing it so that the material of the earth itself can be introduced with bacteria and microorganisms so that it can be inoculated and transformed, turning dead parent material all the way into living, rich, dark, carbon-rich soil.
Yeah, I mean, basically what you're talking about to me sounds like, as human beings, we recognize our own, the biological imperative or whatever. I mean, that we are part of a biological... We work with biology. We work with ecology.
You know,
we are part of it.
Yes.
And in the last,
we're not outside.
Yeah.
In the last couple hundred years, we got into the coal and we got into the oil.
Right.
And what most people, when they're understanding climate change, they look at oil and they see that we're burning it and it's carbon and it goes into the atmosphere.
Right.
But when you think that 50 to 80% of the CO2 is coming from soil, What's really happening is that oil's being used as mechanical energy, and that mechanical energy from oil is what's driving this process. So you really can't separate the oil system from the soil system, and the damage to the soil system is the result of the richness of energy that we have in the current era. We are halfway through the oil supply, if you believe peak oil, and that means we have half of that oil left. We have half of the energy. And that is exactly as much energy as we need in order to undo the damage of the last couple hundred years.
Wow.
So, you know, we can do regenerative practices that slowly over time will work, but a lot of times just establishing a regenerative farm can take 10, 20, 30 years of getting it going when you're moving into a piece of land that hasn't been tended for a long time. We need to be rethinking how we're prioritizing the limited energy budget we have as a people and utilizing the oil, utilizing our intelligence, utilizing our information while we still have it, in order to construct as quickly as possible soil regenerating practices.
I think that's absolutely.
But you're making that sound so daunting. That process of regenerating the land can start happening really quickly.
Yeah, I agree.
Some of these farmers, when they stop doing the soil depleting, the landscape depleting practices like tillage and massive chemical use, they stop doing that stuff. They start bringing animals and introducing animal biodiversity back onto their land. They start doing these things, using cover crops, and they start to see really dramatic changes on their land in a year, in 2 years. So it's...
Yeah. No, I agree entirely. And part of that's because they're not giving up on the tools that they have. They're not giving up on the animals that they already have on site. They're not giving up on their tractors. They're not giving up on their equipment.
Mm-hmm.
We need to be redirecting our current society towards this project. And I think we can do it very rapidly, but we can't just do it with digging sticks and hoping that a sustainable world is pure. We can transform this very quickly. I'm actually super hopeful for us as a people and our ability to transform.
And this is the book that you're working on. I need to let listeners know again, our 15-minute break here. This is the Recovery Zone on KBOO Portland. I'm Stephanie Potter. And today's guests are John Rulak, founder of the Nutiva Company, as well as 5 ecological nonprofit groups, Kristen Olson, author of The Soil Will Save Us, and Jordan Fink, founder of World Tree, who's working on a book about repairing everything. And...
I just wanted to say one more thing about tillage. Isn't that the
yeah,
question that you
yeah,
asked a few
I,
minutes
I, yeah.
ago? Like, why is tillage so bad? I mean, one image that people can keep in their minds about tillage is really that we do have to look at soil as an ecosystem. It's not just inert, dead material that we're walking around on. It's full of these microorganisms. It's full of fungi. It's full of tiny creatures. It's full of life. And anytime a plow goes through and tills up that soil, it's kind of like Hurricane Katrina hitting New Orleans. It's mm-hmm. like it physically is devastation
wow.
for that soil community that's there. And that soil community that's there is so essential in terms of the life of plants. So that's a good image to keep in mind, that it's like this physical devastation of an ecosystem that we can't see, but that doesn't mean it's not there.
Right. It's like when you talk about like a clear cut and how all those trees that are rotting or whatever are putting carbon into the atmosphere. This is more organic matter. It sounds like a lot of organic matter in the dirt, and that's being killed and releasing carbon, as you were saying, right. basically.
Well, everyone's really thinking about 350 is the number, the amount of carbon particles per in the atmosphere, and we're at 400 right now.
Right.
But if we allow current erosion rates to continue, we'll be at 1,200.
Wow.
The amount of carbon that's locked away in the soil that's potentially in the way of the current erosion rates. So we can't continue this. And we can reverse it. We can reverse it fast.
We can totally reverse it. And I saw, like, in some of the articles that you have on your website, Kristen, these lush farm fields and a vineyard where the guy is suddenly having way more grapes than he used to have. I mean, it works. That's what's so incredible about it. I mean, that this actually works to actually increase productivity, and it doesn't cost as much, right?
I know, it's like this incredible win-win thing that it doesn't seem as if it should be possible that something could be that good? but it really is. Yeah, I mean, these farmers who are starting to use these regenerative practices, and you know, and they talk to each other, they talk to scientists. They're really so filled with curiosity and wonder about the earth. And these aren't like the, you know, the farmers that I mostly spend my time talking to are not the small organic farmers that are bringing food to my farmers market. These are commodity farmers in the Midwest who have discovered that for business, you know, they initially start this process either for business reasons or because they have a flash of insight that everything that they're doing, everything that ag school has taught them to do, everything that their fertilizer dealers have told them they should do, everything that their, you know, expensive high-tech seed dealers are telling them they should do, that these things are actually making their land less resilient and threatening their livelihoods as farmers. So they have made this switch not just for, you know, ideological reasons about saving the earth, although what I find fascinating is that they come around to that. You know, once they start to get this, they get this idea that if they work with nature and respect nature and try to be productive within that model, that then they develop this whole this new level of wonder and respect for nature.
Wow, that's incredible. Right.
Industrial agriculture views.
I just wanted to add, I think it was a very, very good point that these ranchers and farmers, they kind of see, for some reason, whether it's economics or whatever, Gabe Brown is an example of that. He's an upper Midwest farmer, and he was basically going to lose the ranch. He was, you know, interviewed that, you know, his neighbors were all just going, "Ha, you know, we're going to be able to pick this up soon, you know, on, you know, in a foreclosure auction," and so he couldn't afford to buy the chemicals anymore, and he changed the way he grows. He grows a lot of cover crops, and was actually growing the crops to feed the animals instead of, you know, buying some of those crops. And so it reduced his costs and increases organic matter. And there's a good little video called, I think it's called Carbon Cowboys, Gabe Brown. If you Google that, you can see that. I just wanted to mention a few resources for people who want to find out a little more. There's a video that Kiss the Ground did on soil. Michael Pollan also did a really good one, the Center for Food Safety. So you can see some of those videos that kind of explain that. And I'm working on a film called Kiss the Ground, is the name. It's also name of one of the environmental groups that's involved in regenerative agriculture. And so we're looking to introduce this film at Sundance in a year from now. It's a major motion picture, and Christine is Olson here on our show here is going to be one of the featured people on it. So it's a way to educate more people through a major motion picture film. There's also the Carbon Underground, Regeneration International. So there's a lot of different groups that are working on this issue. And for those who want to find out even more, there's a conference that I helped work on called Soil Not Oil, and we have it in September every year. In Northern California, and have a lot of different speakers, but it's a lot of good stuff going on. So I'm really glad you had this invited me and brought the show together today.
That's great. And I know you did have to leave early, but you can just sign out whenever you feel like. But meanwhile, we do have a caller named Rodney who wants to ask a question. Rodney, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
What did you want to know or ask?
I wanted to ask why we're not, I hear about the carbon footprint and so on, that we need to diminish it. And what I'm not hearing is there's a really good solution to some of our problem, which is easily dealt with, is we got to start using bamboo as a carbon storing system. It's one of the fastest growing systems on the planet. And it will absorb more carbon than any of the trees or anything. And we need to stop looking at it as a invasive species and start growing it in mass quantities, because it grows so fast and stores so much carbon that it would be a benefit to the planet And I'm talking on a massive scale, and it grows so fast that it needs very little fertilizer. It doesn't need very rich soil. But
okay.
I don't know if everyone has ever looked into this.
Okay, Rodney, thank you. Do you guys have a comment on that?
Bamboo is a great crop. There's a lot that can be done with it for food and fiber and alternatives to wood. It's one of many options and in a lot of sites and as part of a complex polyculture. It's a great option. There's many, many different crops out there. And yeah, you're right. Bamboo is one that's often not looked at.
And we had another caller. Victoria, what was your question?
Hello.
Hello, Victoria?
Yes, Victoria's here.
Great. What would you like to know or ask?
Okay, so... Yeah, I'm on board with you guys about carbon sequestration. I went to a Building Better Soils for Better Crops sustainable soil management sort of seminar. I live in the one of the more fertile parts of the world, North Willamette Valley. And the USDA is part of SARE, which is Sustainable Agriculture Research and Education. And that's what they're talking about. They're talking about the biome, the soil being alive, and you know, cover cropping and all that. But you know, back in 1971, there was a television program, and it was Cousteau, and he warned the entire world with his program about monoculture and current agricultural processes of tilling the soil and killing it and it all flying off and going into the ocean.
Uh-huh. Yeah, well, that's definitely seems to be a predictive thing. And actually what you're saying there, like a monoculture, I think I might worry that if we had nothing but bamboo, that would turn also into a monoculture.
Oh, I'm not on board with bamboo.
Well, it's okay, but maybe we just need a lot of other stuff too. As Kristen was saying, lots of whole myriad of crazy microorganisms and lots of diversity, I think, is also what the planet kind of wants to do when it's on its own. You know.
Right. Well, what I'm thinking, and this is what this is leading up to, is why aren't we talking to the agricultural colleges all over in the United States about this? Why aren't we throwing information into these colleges?
You know, that I think, Kristen, you in one of your articles had some stuff about how the big ag schools, and I think also, John, you had it, aren't on board with this too much. And what's
well,
the deal?
It's very problematic, you know, when...
You know, they're really into the science, and there's plenty of science about improving soils and better soil crops,
right.
Better crops out of soil. And the whole science of carbon sequestration is out there. It just needs to be, you know, piled on top of these ag educational places. You know, like, because they get all these grants from Syngenta and Monsanto. They get all this money to do their research.
Well, that could be the issue.
That's the crux of the problem. You know, as government funding for research at these universities has gone down, private sector funding has gone up. You know, and that private sector funding is just not interested in...
So I think we should be lobbying people who are billionaires and convince these billionaires to spend their money to... lobby the educational facilities around the world, and especially the ag, to get on board with carbon
sequestration. Absolutely, Victoria. But let's talk about this a little more. And John, you had some comment about that too, right?
Yeah. Just wanted to add, you know, very good point. And like, you know, do you think, like, what is the top one of the top ag schools in the country? It's UC Davis. Do you think UC Davis has invited any of the leading experts on or people advocates for regenerative agriculture to come to their school? Do you think when they have seminars and, you know, well-paid, you know, people flying all over to come and talk about agriculture, do you think they ever invite anybody from regenerative agriculture to come and speak and talk about this? They don't. There's people inside that are slowly starting to change. It's not like it's all bad, but there's the amount of money that the large corporations spend is overwhelms us. Now, there's one good bit of news, and that is the first university is going to have actually in the United States that's actually going to focus on regenerative agriculture, and that's Chico State in Northern California, north of Sacramento. And the Center for Regenerative Agriculture is a project that right now is being proposed. It has support from the board, the president of the university, and Tim LaSalle and Rosie Burrows, an organic farmer in California, have been working on that, and that's a good positive thing. So there are some things going on, but I'd encourage everyone why isn't University of Oregon or Oregon State, why are they not teaching more of this? And they may be doing some, but why isn't there more?
They need to invite Jordan.
Yeah. And congrats, Jordan. I really, really enjoyed the way you described the seesaw. That was very powerful. I may have to borrow that from you in one of my next presentations. That's great to see what you're doing. I wanted to mention one other crop, and then I'll let you guys get back into it more. Is there's one crop that I've discovered that I think is a fantastic crop. And it doesn't grow on land, and it grows in the ocean, and that's kelp. And we've lost the vast majority of all the kelp on the Pacific oceans, which used to be a huge kelp forest in the 1800s before the Russians and Spanish came here, and then they depopulated hunt the otters,
yeah.
which were a natural part of the ecosystem to keep other things like urchins, which ate the kelp. So today California is basically barren. There's no kelp forests, and I bet you it's similar in Oregon, and there's challenges there. We can be regrowing this kelp forest through a kind of a permaculture ocean process. If you read one of my articles, I've been talking about this. Brent Smith, ocean farm in Connecticut, and by bringing back this kelp, it sequesters carbon five times faster than plants in the land. And when you have long these big kelp forest areas, whether it's natural or whether we grow them in these farming processes, then it's like the fish come there. It's like it has all this organic matter. It's great for the ecosystem. And for climate change, and we could be growing vast amounts of that. And ironically, it's what we're not doing so much, and we're working to try to get that going in California. I really think Oregon and Washington could be growing lots of kelp forests. I grew up as a young boy spending time in the San Juan Islands and remember looking at all the kelp, off the little islands there. We can grow a lot more there.
Kelp sounds great. Again, just to let the listeners know, you're listening to Kristen, John Rulak, Kristen Olson, author of Soil Will Save Us, and permaculturist Jordan Fink, who hopes to repair society and earth through his organization World Tree. And if you want to call in, the number is 503-231-8187. And we had a caller named Sherry. Is she still there?
I'm here.
Okay, great. What would you like to ask?
Well, I love kelp, but usually when I want to go out to eat, I often order a salad. And I'm actually a small farmer outside of Portland. I live in Corbett, and we grow quite a few. We grow almost, not exclusively, but a lot of annual vegetables. So I'm just wondering how the regenerative, and I'm totally into what you guys say. I want to do my part to make the world a better place. That's partly why I'm a farmer. And so I just wondered, how does it work with annual vegetables? What can we do? I mean, we totally minimize our tillage. We use a spader. We use other kinds of things. We cultivate by hand. We use good open pollinated varieties, and we feel like we're trying to farm with as much concern for the earth as possible. But I just don't know how it would work for your average small farmer that sells at a farmer's market or sells through their CSA or sells to restaurants, but are growing annual vegetables like lettuces.
Okay, does anybody have an answer to that? How can a small farmer do that? Are you using pesticides and fertilizers, Sherry?
Not at all. We're organic.
Okay.
Sherry, it sounds like you're doing almost everything right. I mean, when I'm consulting with farmers, what I usually do is I know that they're going to grow what they need to grow that's right for their business. And almost any crop can be degenerative or it can be regenerative. And I think the issues that are the most important are thinking about what's the larger layout of the farm, how are roads designed, are they moving water or are they contributing to erosion, how are trees planted and how are you organizing tree belts, are you having a diversity of crops, and what's your irrigation system, how are you irrigating your crops, are you, you know, and those are the issues that I think ultimately are the biggest turning points or the pieces, the little switches that can actually contribute to better agricultural practices.
Uh-huh.
But honestly, also, what you're doing sounds like it's, at least at the scale you're talking about, it sounds right.
We're keeping lots of beneficial habitat. We only use drip irrigation.
You sound great.
I think in all those right things, we are hopefully doing the right thing. I'd like to think we are. But isn't there a big difference between primary tillage and secondary tillage?
Yeah.
So like I mentioned, we use a spader. We use a plow later in the year once we can get in there. But when we do use our tiller, we try to limit it to literally the top inch just so we can make a fine enough seed bed so we can seed our annual vegetables.
Yeah.
Is that as bad as, in your opinion, doing the 1 to 1.5 inch tillage the same as doing? I think when you're talking tillage, you're talking about deep tillage.
Right,
right,
right, right. No, it sounds like you're doing great work. You know, some of the farmers that I wrote about in my book, and Gabe Brown was one of the farmers in my book. When I first met him, he was still pretty much a commodity, you know, just in commodity agriculture. He still does that, but he also now is a vegetable farmer for a local farmer's market. And so he's really experimenting and doing what you are, is trying to find all the ways of practicing soil health and organic farming in that kind of smaller space. So I think...
One improvement that I've seen people do is they attach all of the different equipment in line on the same tractor so that the pass of, say, a subsoiler is coming through and immediately it's being inoculated with compost tea or whatever other inoculum you want to have. And the seeder is right there dropping into the slice that gets cut by the subsoiler.
So it's just a little poke in the ground.
Or the harrow is actually put right after that so that it's building the beds on the same pass so that there's as few runs of the tractor as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that kind of like, that's what some people are getting to. And it also saves a lot of time and energy if you can start plugging in your tools in sequence.
Right. Of course, you have to have a powerful tractor to be able to pull all those implements. But yeah, I get
that's
the,
true. Well, that's the nice thing I like about subsoilers is that you can pull them with an SUV. I mean, they're not quite as, you know, they're not quite as a drag.
Right, but you can only do them when the soil's really dried out, and we can
hard here.
We feel like the spader is a pretty good substitute for a tiller at least in the early part of the spring.
Okay, Sherry, I want to thank
awesome,
you
Sherry.
I think thank you guys. Thank you very much.
We have another caller, right? Another Victoria. Victoria, what would you like to ask?
Well, I would like to make a comment. I have a solution I know of for this problem with our soil being dead, and that's to grow camelina. Camelina is an incredible ancient crop, not indigenous to this country, but it was brought here in the 1800s by the immigrants. As part of their culture, it was grown extensively until the 1930s when margarine came into vogue. It's a crop that's very low impact. You plant it, you don't have to do anything to it until you harvest it. It can be grown anywhere. It might not be a good food grade for anywhere, but it is a good a restoration for the soil.
Right.
Go ahead.
I was just thinking, it sounds like maybe what you're talking about is another cover crop. And what I sort of understood when I was reading about this is that different soils are all sort of in different spaces with what
Goodbye.
They might need or might not want. Is that, would you guys say that? That for instance, like one kind of soil would require this kind of cover crop and another sort of soil?
So, well, I think, you know, some of these farmers who are working with scientists and really doing some interesting work, they're looking how different crops concentrate different cover crops concentrate different needed minerals in the soil.
Right.
I think that mostly the consensus seems to be that the more diversity in the cover crop, so you have somebody like... you know, some of the farmers like Gabe Brown having 30, 40, 50 different species in a cover crop to have a variety of root depth and to have, every plant puts out a sort of its own recipe of carbon exudate. So it's doing something different. Every plant is doing something a little bit differently. And there are microorganisms in the soil that preferentially feed on different plants. So the greater diversity that we're bringing to agricultural lands, the better for the soil.
And so, also, what were you going to say?
Well, I was going to say, you know, we've been talking about these sort of large farm operations, but I'm sure a lot of the listeners have a yard or have a parking strip or have, you know, something that they're engaged with soil. And everyone who's gardened knows that you look at your garden and you may have different weeds than your neighbors. And that may have to do with what's going on in the soil conditions. So if it's really compact, you might get these really deep taproot plants that can push their way through the soil. And they're telling you whether you have enough calcium in the soil, really, because calcium causes, or lack of calcium can cause compaction in soils. Mm-hmm. So if you look at those weeds and you see you're having dandelions, or you're having thistle, or you're having dock, these really like deep taproots, then it, you can sort of think about what needs to happen is a loosening of the soil. But maybe your soil is in a completely different case. It's so compacted, but it's holding water. And that's why all those mosses and rings of fairy mushrooms are showing up in your yard. So, you know, you're starting to think about what are the different weeds really can help you think about what might be the most appropriate treatment in a place. You know, what I often find in Portland, people's yards are waterlogged and the grass is all dyed back in the winter and in the summer. So one of the things that you can do in your garden is to throw a mix of different cover crops. And one of the ones I really like is to mix a clover or a vetch or something that's nitrogen fixing with a daikon radish. Because if you throw daikon radishes into your yard, they'll grow this giant taproot that you don't harvest. You let it just die there. You can harvest a few if you want to make kimchi or something. But it forms a compost column in your yard. It can help till and aerate the soil. And that's a lot easier if you're working in your backyard. So people can be thinking about these own things just to improve their own lawn or improve their own garden. And when you cover crop, you're also encouraging a plant that you know what it's going to do and how it's going to live. And weeds that maybe are going to take a better stronghold, or it's going to be really hard to get rid of them, you know, you can avoid that.
But
so
in
I recommend that people start thinking about these things, keeping a living, because those microorganisms need some plant feeding them all the time.
Right. So, yeah, like there was this nice quote that was in an article from Kristen. A typical field. Look at that soil, says David Lamb, and he's works with the national. He's a national soil health team leader. It's naked, hungry, thirsty, and running a fever. And why would he describe it that way? It's just a dead dirt as opposed to living soil is the basic impression you get when you. And if we could just look at farm fields in our own yards that way, that they don't need to be, you know, all the leaves blown away with an air blower, and you know, a little bit messy, a little bit let things live, you know.
And I think it's interesting that when, you know, the most beautiful gardens, the ones that are in Sunset Magazine or whatever, like really beautiful, they're horticultural gardens that have a lot of messiness and disorder to them. You know, you can go to some corporate campus and see trees planted in a row and they're all over manicured, but the beautiful gardens, the ones that are sort of semi-wild, have multiple layers, trees and then shrubs beneath them, and plants with big leaves and small leaves, plants of different types, maybe a little bit of annuals here and there, especially in the spring or in certain times, but other perennials in other places. Having a patchwork and a mosaic is aesthetically beautiful too. It doesn't have to just, it can appeal to our sense of beauty and sort of a higher sense of order.
Well, and I think it's aesthetically beautiful because that was the world that we inherited. That
right.
was the world
Absolutely.
That we evolved in. You know, there's a reason that we find that beautiful.
But imagine a garden if it looked like, you know, a beautiful, like looked like the Japanese gardens, or looked like some place that, you know, you went that you would want to take a photo of or have a postcard from. That's what agriculture systems can look like. And when you look at the systems, the beautiful prairies that are being put out by sustainable carbon farming grazers, or places that are beautiful swaths of trees growing in the middle of fields to make sure that there's the right balance of moisture on the landscape, or that there's somewhere for cows to hide in the hot summer sun. We can have diverse, complex, beautiful ecologies that also feed us and nourish us. And right. I don't think that there's anything to be afraid of about that.
Yeah, I think it sounds beautiful. And so I guess we're running really short of time, but I don't even want to get this started in a way, but one last thought I had is that trying to get these back to like governmental policies, and I know that it's hard in a Trump environment right now, but
it was hard before.
It was hard before.
You know, it was hard before.
Right. It's like we all have to be doing our bit with this, basically. You know, and so but anyway, we are running out of time. Do you guys have any last words on that?
Well, on the issue of the politics side of it, you know, to be honest, we have to figure this out for ourselves now. Like, the time is short. We need to be repairing the planet as quickly as possible. And that means that, you know, if governments and political entities want to contribute or want to contribute to carbon sequestration, that's wonderful, and I'm hoping those grants are still available. But the truth is that there needs to be economic models that allow for us to transform our economy and our ecology and our agriculture systems. That's one of the things that we're trying to do with World Tree, right, as an organization, is trying to figure out what's that point that allows for people to economically make the shift. And we're trying to figure out what that balance is.
Yeah, it's great.
And I guess I just wanted to say, you know, that life is there waiting to happen. Mm-hmm. You know, when we stop doing the damage that we do to our environment, life springs back, yeah, really in amazing ways that surprise people all the time. So I think that, you know, that's the, yeah, hope of all this.
Yeah, just look at the big explosion of the volcano up in Washington. I can't think of the mountain.
That's in Helens.
Yeah, and life is just flourishing there now. Yeah.
It's true.
Okay, things come back. We've just got to give them a chance. That's our message, mm-hmm, here. Okay, you've been listening to author Kristen Olson, who wrote The Soil Will Save Us, and many articles on this topic. Just check her website, kristenolson.com. Also, Jordan Fink, founder of World Tree, who's working on a book on how we can repair our planet, and he wants to get that funded, a crowdfunder.
Well, our organization's website is worldtree.land.
Worldtree.land.
It's just a splash page at this moment, but you can sign up for updates.
Good. And finally, John Rulak, who's businessman, author, and environmentalist, who writes for Earthwatch and has founded 5 ecological nonprofit groups, including the Nativa Foundation. This has been the Recovery Zone on KBOO Portland, your non-corporate volunteer community radio station. I'm Stephanie Potter. Thanks to Tammy for her fine engineering, and thank you for listening.
The time is 12 o'clock. Good afternoon. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Skyline Tavern Project, a not-for-profit historic saloon at the edge of Forest Park dedicated to supporting art and ecology through live music, food, and horseshoes, 8031 Northwest Skyline Boulevard and skytav.com. Stay tuned for Jazz Lives. Nick is in the house, ready to bring you some fine music. And thanks for tuning into KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is also available